John Delavan had been sitting on the edge of Kevin's bed with his arm about his son's shoulders. Now he stood up. "Get dressed. I'll go downstairs and call in. I'll tell Brandon I'll probably just be late, but to assume I won't be in at all." He was preoccupied with this, already talking to Brandon Reed in his mind, but not so preoccupied he didn't see the gratitude which lighted his son's worried face. Mr. Delavan smiled a little, and felt that uncharacteristic gloom first ease and then go entirely. There was this much, at least. His son was not yet too old to take comfort from him, or accept him as a higher power, to whom appeals could sometimes be directed in the knowledge that they would be acted upon. Nor was he himself too old to take comfort from his son's comfort. "I think," he said, moving toward the door, "that we ought to pay a call on Pop Merrill." He glanced at the clock on Kevin's night table. It was 8:10, and in back of the Emporium Glorium, a sledgehammer was coming down on an imitation German cuckoo clock. "He usually opens around 8:30. Just about the time we'll get there, I think. If you get a wiggle on, that is." He paused on his way out, and a brief, cold smile flickered on his mouth. He was not smiling at his son. "I think he's got some explaining to do, is what I mean to say." Mr. Delavan went out, closing the door behind him. Kevin quickly began to dress. The Castle Rock Laverdier Super Drugstore was a lot more than just a drugstore. Put another way, it was really only a drugstore as an afterthought. It was as if someone had noticed at the last moment, just before the grand opening, say, that one of the words in the sign was still drug. That someone might have made a mental note to tell someone else, someone in the company's management, that here they were, opening yet another Laverdier's, and they had, by simple oversight, neglected yet again to correct the sign so it read, more simply and accurately, Laverdier's Superstore. And, after making the mental note, the someone in charge of noticing such things had delayed the grand opening a day or two so they could shoehorn in a prescription counter about the size of a telephone booth in the long building's furthest, darkest, and most neglected corner. The Laverdier's Super Drugstore was really more of a jumped-up five-and-dime than anything else. The town's last real five-and-dime, a long, dim room with feeble, fly-specked overhead globes hung on chains and reflected murkily in the creaking but often waxed wooden floor, had been the Ben Franklin store. It had given up the ghost in 1978 to make way for a video games arcade called Galaxia and Easy Video Rentals, where Tuesday was Twofer's Day, and no one under the age of 20 could go in the back room. Laverdier's carried everything the old Ben Franklin had carried, but the goods were bathed in the pitiless light of maxi-glow fluorescent bars, which gave every bit of stock its own hectic, feverish shimmer. "Buy me," each item seemed to shriek. "Buy me, or you may die, or your wife may die, or your kids, or your best friend, possibly all of them at once. Why? How should I know? I'm just a brainless item sitting on a prefab Laverdier shelf. But doesn't it feel true? You know it does. So buy me, and buy me right now." There was an aisle of notions, two aisles of first aid supplies and nostrums, an aisle of video and audio tapes, both blank and pre-recorded. There was a long rack of magazines giving way to paperback books, a display of lighters under one digital cash register, and a display of watches under another. A third register was hidden in the dark corner where the pharmacist lurked in his lonely shadows. Halloween candy had taken over most of the toy aisle. The toys would not only come back after Halloween, but eventually take over two whole aisles as the days slid remorselessly down towards Christmas. And like something too neat to exist in reality, except as a kind of dumb admission that there was such a thing as fate with a capital F, and that fate might in its own way indicate the existence of that whole other world about which Pop had never before cared, except in terms of how it might fatten his pocketbook, that was, and about which Kevin Delavan had never before even thought. At the front of the store, in the main display area, was a carefully arranged work of salesmanship, which was billed as the Fall Photo Festival. This display consisted of a basket of colorful autumn leaves, spilled out on the floor in a bright flood, a flood too large actually to have come from that one basket alone, a careful observer might have concluded. Amid the leaves were a number of Kodak and Polaroid cameras, several Sun 660s among the latter, and all sorts of other equipment, cases, albums, film, flash bars. In the midst of this odd cornucopia, an old-fashioned tripod rose, like one of H.G. Wells's Martian death machines towering over the crispy wreck of London. It bore a sign which told all patrons interested enough to look that this week one could obtain super reductions on all Polaroid cameras and accessories. At 8:30 that morning, half an hour after Laverdier's opened for the day, all patrons consisted of Pop Merrill and Pop alone. He took no notice of the display, but marched straight to the only open counter, where Molly Durham had just finished laying out the watches on their imitation velvet display cloth. "Oh, no, here comes old Eyeballs," she thought, and grimaced. Pop's idea of a really keen way to kill a stretch of time about as long as Molly's coffee break was to kind of ooze up to the counter where she was working. He always picked hers, even if he had to stand in line. In fact, she thought he liked it better when there was a line, and buy a pouch of Prince Albert tobacco. This was a purchase an ordinary fellow could transact in 30 seconds, but if she got Eyeballs out of her face in under 3 minutes, she thought she was doing very well indeed. He kept all of his money in a cracked leather purse on a chain, and he'd haul it out of his pocket, giving his doorbells a good feel on the way it always looked to Molly, and then open it. It always gave out a little squeak noise, and honest to God, if you didn't expect to see a moth flutter out of it, just like in those cartoons people draw of tightwads. On top of the purse's contents, there would be a whole mess of paper money, bills that looked somehow as if you shouldn't handle them, as if they might be coated with disease germs of some kind, and jingling silver underneath. Pop would fish out a dollar bill, and then kind of hook the other bills to one side with one of those thick fingers of his to get to the change underneath. He'd never give you a couple of bucks. Uh-uh. That would make everything too quick to suit him. And then he'd work that out, too. And all the time, his eyes would be busy, flicking down to the purse for a second or two, but mostly letting the fingers sort out the proper coins by touch while his eyes crawled over her boobs, her belly, her hips, and then back up to her boobs again. Never once her face, not even so far as her mouth, which was a part of a girl in which most men seemed to be interested. No, Pop Merrill was strictly interested in the lower portions of the female anatomy. When he finally finished, and no matter how quick that was, it always seemed like 3 times as long to Molly, and got the hell out of the store again, she always felt like going somewhere and taking a long shower. So she braced herself, put on her best, "It's only 8:30 and I've got 7.5 hours to go," smile, and stood at the counter as Pop approached. She told herself, "He's only looking at you. Guys have been doing that since you sprouted." And that was true, but this wasn't the same, because Pop Merrill wasn't like most of the guys who had run their eyes over her trim and eminently watchable superstructure since that time 10 years ago. Part of it was that Pop was old, but that wasn't all of it. The truth was that some guys looked at you, and some, a very few, seemed to actually be feeling you up with their eyes, and Merrill was one of those. His gaze actually seemed to have weight when he fumbled in his creaky old maid's purse on its length of incongruously masculine chain. She seemed to actually feel his eyes squirming up and down her front, lashing their way up her heels on their optic nerves like tadpoles and then sliding bonelessly down into her valleys, making her wish she had worn a nun's habit to work that day, or maybe a suit of armor. But her mother had been fond of saying, "What can't be cured must be endured, sweet Molly." And until someone discovered a method of weighing gazes, so those of dirty men, both young and old, could be outlawed, or, more likely, until Pop Merrill did everyone in Castle Rock a favor by dying so that eyesore of a tourist trap he kept could be torn down, she would just have to deal with it as best she could. But today, she was in for a pleasant surprise, or so it seemed at first. Pop's usual hungry appraisal was not even an ordinary patron's look. It seemed utterly blank. It wasn't that he looked through her, or that his gaze struck her and bounced off. It seemed to Molly that he was so deep in his thoughts that his usually penetrating look did not even reach her, but made it about halfway and then petered out, like a man trying to locate and observe a star on the far side of the galaxy with just the naked eye. "May I help you, Mr. Merrill?" she asked, and her feet were already cocking so she could turn quickly and reach up for where the pouches of tobacco were kept. With Pop, this was a task she always did as quickly as possible, because when she turned and reached, she could feel his eyes crawling busily over her ass, dropping for a quick check of her legs, then rising again to her butt for a final ocular squeeze and perhaps a pinch before she turned back.
"Yes?"
he said calmly and serenely. And he might as well have been talking to one of those automated bank machines, for all the interest in her he showed. That was fine by Molly.
"I'd like some..."
And then either a word she didn't hear right, or one that was utter gibberish. If it was gobbledygook, she thought with some hope, maybe the first few parts of the complicated network of dikes, levees, and spillways the old croc had constructed against the rising sea of senility were finally giving way. It sounded as if he had said, "Toe-filled Mako," which wasn't a product they stocked unless it was a prescription drug of some sort. "I beg pardon, Mr. Merrill?"
"Film," he said.
So clearly and firmly that Molly was more than disappointed. She was convinced he must have said it just that way the first time, and her ears had picked it up wrong. Maybe she was the one who was beginning to lose her dikes and levees. "What kind would you like?"
"Polaroid," he said. "Two packs."
She didn't know exactly what was going on here, but it was beyond doubt that Castle Rock's premier dirty old man was not himself today. His eyes would still not focus. And the words, they reminded her of something, something she associated with her 5-year-old niece, Ellen, but she couldn't catch hold of it. "For what model, Mr. Merrill?" She sounded brittle and actressy to herself, but Pop Merrill didn't even come close to noticing. Pop was lost in the ozone. After a moment's consideration, in which he did not look at her at all, but seemed instead to study the racks of cigarettes behind her left shoulder, he jerked out,
"For a Polaroid Sun Camera Model 660.
And then it came to her. Even as she told him she'd have to get it from the display, her niece owned a big, soft panda toy, which she had, for reasons which would probably make sense only to another little girl, named Paulette. Somewhere inside of Paulette was an electronic circuit board and a memory chip, on which were stored about 400 short, simple sentences, such as,
"I like to hug, don't you?"
and
"I wish you'd never go away."
Whenever you poked Paulette above her fuzzy little navel, there was a brief pause, and then one of those lovesome little remarks would come out, almost jerk out, in a somehow remote and emotionless voice that seemed by its tone to deny the content of the words. Ellen thought Paulette was nuts. Molly thought there was something creepy about it. She kept expecting Ellen to poke the panda doll in the gut someday, and it would surprise them all, except for Aunt Molly from Castle Rock, by saying what was really on its mind.
"I think tonight, after you're asleep, I'll strangle you dead."
Perhaps. Or maybe just,
"I have a knife."
Pop Merrill sounded like Paulette the stuffed panda this morning. His blank gaze was uncannily like Paulette's. Molly had thought any change from the old man's usual leer would be a welcome one. She had been wrong. Molly bent over the display, for once totally unconscious of the way her rump was poking out, and tried to find what the old man wanted as quickly as she could. She was sure that when she turned around, Pop would be looking at anything but her. This time, she was right. When she had the film and started back, brushing a couple of errant fall leaves from one of the boxes, Pop was still staring at the cigarette racks, at first glance appearing to look so closely he might have been inventorying the stock. It took a second or two to see that that expression was no expression at all, really, but a gaze of almost divine blankness. "Please get out of here," Molly prayed. "Please just take your film and go, and whatever else you do, don't touch me, please." If he touched her while he was looking like that, Molly thought she would scream. Why did the place have to be empty? Why couldn't at least one other customer be in here? Preferably Sheriff Pangborn. But since he seemed to be otherwise engaged, anyone at all. She supposed Mr. Constantine, the pharmacist, was in the store someplace, but the drug counter looked easily a quarter of a mile away. And while she knew it couldn't be that far, not really, it was still too far for him to reach her in a hurry if old man Merrill decided to touch her. And suppose Mr. Constantine had gone out to Nan's for coffee with Mr. Keaton from the selectman's office. The more she thought about that possibility, the more likely it seemed. When something genuinely weird like this happened, wasn't it an almost foregone conclusion that it should happen while one was alone? He's having a mental breakdown of some kind. She heard herself saying with glassy cheerfulness, "Here you are, Mr. Merrill." She put the film on the counter and scooted to her left and behind the register at once, wanting it between her and him. The ancient leather purse came out of Pop Merrill's pants, and her stuttering fingers miskeyed the purchase so she had to clear the register and start again. He was holding two $10 bills out to her. She told herself they were only rumpled from being squashed up with the other bills in that little pocketbook. Probably not even old, although they looked old. That didn't stop her galloping mind, however. Her mind insisted that they weren't just rumpled, they were rumpled and slimy. It further insisted that old wasn't the right word, that old wasn't even in the ballpark. For those particular items of currency, not even the word ancient would do. Those were prehistoric tens, somehow printed before Christ was born and Stonehenge was built, before the first low-browed, no-neck Neanderthal had crawled out of his cave. They belonged to a time when even God had been a baby. She didn't want to touch them. She had to touch them. The man would want his change. Steeling herself, she took the bills and shoved them into the cash register as fast as she could, banging a finger so hard she ripped most of the nail clear off, an ordinarily exquisite pain she would not notice in her extreme state of distress until sometime later, when that was, she had chivied her willing mind around enough to scold herself for acting like a whoopsie little girl on the edge of her first menstrual period. At the moment, however, she only concentrated on getting the bills into the register as fast as she could and getting her hand off them. But even later she would remember what the surfaces of those tens had felt like. It felt as if they were actually crawling and moving under the pads of her fingers, as if billions of germs, huge germs, almost big enough to be seen with a naked eye, were sliding along them toward her, eager to infect her with whatever he had. But the man would want his change. She concentrated on that, lips pressed together so tightly they were dead white, four singles that did not, absolutely did not want to come out from beneath the roller that held them down in the cash drawer. Then a dime. But, oh, Jesus, please us, there were no dimes. And what the hell was wrong with her? What had she done to be settled for so long with this weird old man on the one morning in recorded history when he actually seemed to want to get out of here in a hurry? She fished out a nickel, feeling the silent, stinky loom of him so close to her, and she felt that when she was finally forced to look up, she would see he was even closer, that he was leaning over the counter toward her. Then three pennies, four, five. But the last one dropped back into the drawer among the quarters, and she had to fish for it with one of her cold, numb fingers. It almost squirted away from her again. She could feel sweat popping out on the nape of her neck and on the little strip of skin between her nose and her upper lip. Then, clutching the coins tightly in her fist and praying he wouldn't have his hand outstretched to receive them so she would have to touch his dry, reptilian skin, but knowing, somehow knowing that he would, she looked up, feeling her bright and cheery Laverdiere smile stretching the muscles of her face in a kind of frozen scream, trying to steel herself for even that, telling herself it would be the last, and never mind the image her stupid, insisting mind kept trying to make her see, an image of that dry hand suddenly snapping shut over hers like the talon of some old and horrid bird. A bird not of prey, no, not even that, but one of carrion. She told herself she did not see those images, absolutely did not, and seeing them all the same, she looked up with that smile screaming off her face as brightly as a cry of murder on a hot, still night, and the store was empty. Pop was gone. He had left while she was making change. Molly began to shudder all over. If she had needed concrete proof that the old geezer was not right, this was it. This was proof positive, proof indubitable, proof of the purest ray serene. For the first time in her memory, and in the living memory of the town, she would have bet, and she would have won her bet, Pop Merrill, who refused to tip even on those rare occasions when he was forced to eat in a restaurant that had no takeout service, had left a place of business without waiting for his change. Molly tried to open her hand and let go of the four ones, the nickel, and the five pennies. She was stunned to find she couldn't do it. She had to reach over with her other hand and pry the fingers loose. Pop's change dropped to the glass top of the counter, and she swept it off to one side, not wanting to touch it. And she never wanted to see Pop Merrill again. Pop's vacant gaze held as he left Laverdier's. It held as he crossed the sidewalk with the boxes of film in his hand. It broke and became an expression of somehow unsettling alertness as he stepped off into the gutter and stopped there, with one foot on the sidewalk and one planted amid the litter of squashed cigarette butts and empty potato chip bags. Here was another Pop Molly would not have recognized, although there were those who had been sharp-traded by the old man who would have known it quite well. This was neither Merrill the Lecher nor Merrill the Robot, but Merrill the Animal with its wind up. All at once, he was there. In a way, he seldom allowed himself to be there in public. Showing so much of one's true self in public was not, in Pop's estimation, a good idea. This morning, however, he was far from being in command of himself, and there was no one out to observe him anyway. If there had been, that person would not have seen Pop the folksy Cracker Barrel philosopher, or even Pop the sharp trader, but something like the spirit of the man. In that moment of being totally there, Pop looked like a rogue dog himself, a stray who has gone feral, and now pauses amid a midnight henhouse slaughter, raggedy ears up, head cocked, blood-streaked teeth showing a little as he hears some sound from the farmer's house and thinks of the shotgun with its wide black holes like a figure eight rolled onto its side. The dog knows nothing of figure eights, but even a dog may recognize the dim shape of eternity if its instincts are honed sharp enough. Across the town square, he could see the urine-yellow front of the Emporium Galorium. Standing slightly apart from its nearest neighbors, the vacant building, which had housed the village washtub until earlier that year, Nan's Luncheonette, and You So and So, the dress and notions shop run by Evie Chalmers' great-granddaughter, Polly, a woman of whom we must speak at another time. There were slant parking spaces in front of all the shops on Lower Main Street, and all of them were empty, except for one, which was just now being filled with a Ford station wagon Pop recognized. The light throb of its engine was clearly audible in the morning still air. Then it cut off. The brake lights went out, and Pop pulled back the foot which had been in the gutter and prudently withdrew himself to the corner of Laverdier's. Here he stood, as still as that dog who has been alerted in the henhouse by some small sound, the sort of sound which might be disregarded in the killing frenzy of dogs neither so old nor so wise as this one. John Delavan got out from behind the wheel of the station wagon. The boy got out on the passenger side. They went to the door of the Emporium Galorium. The man began to knock impatiently, loud enough so the sound of it came as clearly to Pop as the sound of the engine had done. Delavan paused. They both listened. And then Delavan started in again, not knocking now, but hammering at the door. And you didn't have to be a goddamn mind reader to know the man was steamed up.
They know, Pop thought. Somehow they know. Damn good thing I smashed the fucking camera.
He stood a moment longer, nothing moving except his hooded eyes, and then he slipped around the corner of the drugstore and into the alley between it and the neighboring bank. He did it so smoothly that a man 50 years younger might have envied the almost effortless agility of the movement. This morning, Pop figured, it might be a little wiser to go back home by Backyard Express. When there was still no answer, John Delavan went at the door a third time, hammering so hard he made the glass rattle loosely in its rotting putty gums and hurt his hand. It was hurting his hand that made him realize how angry he was. Not that he felt the anger was in any way unjustified. If Merrill had done what Kevin thought he had done, and yes, the more he thought about it, the more John Delavan was sure that Kevin was right. But he was surprised that he hadn't recognized the anger for what it was until just now. This seems to be a morning for learning about myself, he thought, and there was something schoolmarmish in that. It allowed him to smile and relax a little. Kevin was not smiling, nor did he look relaxed. It seems like one of three things has happened, Mr. Delavan said to his son. Merrill's either not up, not answering the door, or he figured we were getting warm and he's absconded with your camera. He paused, then actually laughed. I guess there's a fourth, too. Maybe he died in his sleep. He didn't die. Kevin now stood with his head against the dirty glass of the door he mightily wished he had never gone through in the first place. He had his hands cupped around his eyes to make blinders, because the sun rising over the east side of the town square ran a harsh glare across the glass. Look! Mr. Delavan cupped his own hands to the sides of his face and pressed his nose to the glass. They stood there side by side, backs to the square, looking into the dimness of the Emporium Galorium like the world's most dedicated window shoppers. Well, he said after a few seconds, it looks like if he absconded, he left his shit behind. Yeah, but that's not what I mean. Do you see it?
See what?
Hanging on that post, the one by the bureau with all the clocks on it. And after a moment, Mr. Delavan did see it, a Polaroid camera, hanging by its strap from a hook on the post. He thought he could even see the chipped place, although that might have been his imagination. It's not your imagination. The smile faded off his lips as he realized he was starting to feel what Kevin was feeling, the weird and distressing certainty that some simple yet terribly dangerous piece of machinery was running. And unlike most of Pop's clocks, it was running right on time. Do you think he's just sitting upstairs and waiting for us to go away? Mr. Delavan spoke aloud, but he was really talking to himself. The lock on the door looked both new and expensive, but he was willing to bet that if one of them, probably Kevin was in better shape, hit the door hard enough, it would rip right through the old wood. He mused randomly. A lock is only as good as the door you put it in. People never think. Kevin turned his strained face to look at his father. In that moment, John Delavan was as struck by Kevin's face as Kevin had been by his not long ago. He thought, I wonder how many fathers get a chance to see what their sons will look like as men. He won't always look this strained, this tightly drawn, God, I hope not, but this is what he will look like. And Jesus, he's going to be handsome. He, like Kevin, had that one moment in the midst of whatever it was that was going on here, and that moment was a short one, but he also never forgot. It was always within his mind's reach. What? Kevin said hoarsely. What, Dad? You want to bust it? Because I'd go along.
Not yet. I don't think we'll have to. I don't think he's here, but he's close.
You can't know any such thing. Can't even think it. But his son did think it. And he believed Kevin was right. Some sort of link had been formed between Pop and his son. Some sort of link? Get serious. He knew perfectly well what that link was. It was that fucking camera hanging on the wall in there. And the longer this went on, the longer he felt that machinery running, its gears grinding, and its vicious, unthinking cogs turning, the less he liked it. Break the camera, break the link, he thought, and said, Are you sure, Kev? Let's go around the back. Try the door there. There's a gate. He'll keep it locked. Maybe we can climb over. Okay, Mr. Delavan said, and followed his son down the steps of the Emporium Galorium and around to the alley, wondering, as he went, if he had lost his mind. But the gate wasn't locked. Somewhere along the line, Pop had forgotten to lock it. And although Mr. Delavan hadn't liked the idea of climbing over the fence, or maybe falling over the fence, quite likely tearing the hell out of his balls in the process, he somehow liked the open gate even less. All the same, he and Kevin went through it and into Pop's littered backyard, which not even the drifts of fallen October leaves could improve. Kevin wove his way through the piles of junk Pop had thrown out but not bothered to take to the dump, and Mr. Delavan followed him. They arrived at the chopping block at about the same time Pop was coming out of Mrs. Althea Linden's backyard and onto Mulberry Street, a block west. He would follow Mulberry Street until he reached the offices of the Wolf Jaw Lumber Company. Although the company's pulp trucks would already be coursing the roads of western Maine, and the yowl and yark of the cutter's chainsaws would have been rising from the area's diminishing stands of hardwood since 6:30 or so, no one would come in to man the office until 9, which was still a good 15 minutes away. At the rear of the lumber company's tiny backyard was a high board fence. It was gated, and this gate was locked, but Pop had the key. He would unlock the gate and step through into his own backyard. Kevin reached the chopping block. Mr. Delavan caught up, followed his son's gaze, and blinked. He opened his mouth to ask what in the hell this was all about, then shut it again. He was starting to have an idea of what in the hell it was all about without any aid from Kevin. It wasn't right to have such ideas. It wasn't natural, and he knew from bitter experience, in which Reginald Marion Pop Merrill himself had played a part at one point, as he had told his son not long ago, that doing things on impulse was a good way to reach the wrong decision and go flying off half-cocked, but it didn't matter. Although he did not think of it in such terms, it would be fair to say Mr. Delavan just hoped he could apply for readmittance to the reasonable tribe when this was all over. At first he thought he was looking at the smashed remains of a Polaroid camera. Of course, that was just his mind trying to find a little rationality in repetition. What lay on and around the chopping block didn't look anything at all like a camera, Polaroid or otherwise. All those gears and flywheels could only belong to a clock. Then he saw the dead cartoon bird and even knew what kind of clock. He opened his mouth to ask Kevin why in God's name Pop would bring a cuckoo clock out back and then sledgehammer it to death. He thought over again and decided he didn't have to ask after all. The answer to that was also beginning to come. He didn't want it to come, because it pointed to madness on what seemed to Mr. Delavan a grand scale. But that didn't matter. It came anyway. You had to hang a cuckoo clock on something. You had to hang it because of the pendulum weights. And what did you hang it on? Why, a hook, of course. Maybe a hook sticking out of a beam, like the beam Kevin's Polaroid had been hanging on. Now he spoke, and his words seemed to come from some long distance away. What in the hell is wrong with him, Kevin? Has he gone nuts? Not gone, Kevin answered, and his voice also seemed to come from some long distance away as they stood above the chopping block looking down on the busted timepiece. Driven there, by the camera. We've got to smash it, Mr. Delavan said. His voice seemed to float to his ears long after he had felt the words coming out of his mouth. Not yet, Kevin said. We have to go to the drugstore first. They're having a special sale on... Kevin touched his arm. John Delavan looked at him. Kevin's head was up, and he looked like a deer scenting fire. In that moment, the boy was more than handsome. He was almost divine, like a young poet at the hour of his death. What? Mr. Delavan asked urgently. Did you hear something? Alertness slowly changing to doubt. A car on the street, Mr. Delavan said. How much older was he than his son? He wondered suddenly. 25 years? Jesus, wasn't it time he started acting it? He pushed the strangeness away from him, trying to get it at arm's length. He groped desperately for his maturity and found a little of it, putting it on like he was putting on a badly tattered overcoat. You sure that's all it was, Dad? Yes, Kevin. You're wound up too tight. Get a hold of yourself, or... Or what? But he knew, and laughed shakily. Or you'll have us both running like a pair of rabbits. Kevin looked at him thoughtfully for a moment, like someone coming out of a deep sleep, perhaps even a trance, and then nodded. Come on, Kevin, why? What do you want? He could be upstairs, just not answering.
I'll tell you when we get there, Dad. Come on.
And almost dragged his father out of the littered backyard and into the narrow alleyway. Kevin, do you want to take my arm off or what? Mr. Delavan asked when they got back to the sidewalk.
He was back there, Kevin said, hiding, waiting for us to go. I felt him.
He was... Mr. Delavan stopped, then started again. Well, let's just say he was, just for argument. Let's say he was. Shouldn't we go back there and collar him? And belatedly, where was he?
On the other side of the fence, Kevin said.
His eyes seemed to be floating. Mr. Delavan liked this less all the time.
He's already been. He's already got what he needs. We'll have to hurry.
Kevin was already starting for the edge of the sidewalk, meaning to cut across the town square to Laverdiere's. Mr. Delavan reached out and grabbed him like a conductor grabbing a fellow who's caught trying to sneak aboard a train without a ticket.
Kevin, what are you talking about?
And then Kevin actually said it, looked at him, and said it.
It's coming, Dad. Please. It's my life.
He looked at his father, pleading with his pallid face and his fey, floating eyes.
The dog is coming. It won't do any good to just break in and take the camera. It's gone way past that now. Please don't stop me. Please don't wake me up. It's my life.
Mr. Delavan made one last great effort not to give in to this creeping craziness, and then succumbed. Come on, he said, hooking his hand around his son's elbow and almost dragging him into the square. Whatever it is, let's get it done. He paused. Do we have enough time?
I'm not sure, Kevin said, and then reluctantly, I don't think so.
Pop waited behind the board fence, looking at the Delavans through a knothole. He had put his tobacco in his back pocket so that his hands would be free to clench and unclench, clench and unclench.
You're on my property,
his mind whispered at them, and if his mind had had the power to kill, he would have reached out with it and struck them both dead.
You're on my property, goddammit. You're on my property.
What he ought to do was to go get old John Law and bring him down on their fancy Castle View heads. That was what he ought to do. And he would have done it, too, right then, if they hadn't been standing over the wreckage of the camera the boy himself had supposedly destroyed with Pop's blessing 2 weeks ago. He thought maybe he would have tried to bullshit his way through anyway, but he knew how they felt about him in this town. Pangborn, Keaton, all the rest of them. Trash. That's what they thought of him, trash. Until they got their asses in a crack and needed a fast loan and the sun was down, that was. Clench, unclench, clench, unclench. They were talking, but Pop didn't bother listening to what they were saying. His mind was a fuming forge. Now the litany had become, they're on my goddamn property and I can't do a thing about it.
They're on my goddamn property and I can't do a thing about it. Goddamn them. Goddamn them.
At last they left. When he heard the rusty screech of the gate in the alley, Pop used his key on the one in the board fence. He slipped through and ran across the yard to his back door. Ran with an unsettling fleetness for a man of 70, with one hand clapped firmly against his upper right leg, as if, fleet or not, he was fighting a bad rheumatism pain there. In fact, Pop was feeling no pain at all. He didn't want either his keys or the change in his purse jingling, that was all, in case the Delavans were still there, lurking just beyond where he could see. Pop wouldn't have been surprised if they were doing just that. When you're dealing with skunks, you expect them to get up to stinking didos. He slipped his keys out of his pocket. Now they rattled, and although the sound was muted, it seemed very loud to him. He cut his eyes to the left for a moment, sure he would see the brat's staring sheep's face. Pop's mouth was set in a hard, strained grin of fear. There was no one there. Yet, anyway. He found the right key, slipped it into the lock, and went in. He was careful not to open the door to the shed too wide, because the hinges picked up a squeal when you exercised them too much. Inside, he turned the thumb bolt with a savage twist, and then went into the Emporium Galorium. He was more than at home in these shadows. He could have negotiated the narrow, junk-lined corridors in his sleep, had, in fact, although that, like a good many other things, had slipped his mind for the time being. There was a dirty little side window near the front of the store that looked out upon the narrow alleyway the Delavans had used to trespass their way into his backyard. It also gave a sharply angled view on the sidewalk and part of the town common. Pop slipped up to this window between piles of useless, valueless magazines that breathed their dusty yellow museum scent into the dark air. He looked out into the alley and saw it empty. He looked to the right and saw the Delavans, wavery as fish in an aquarium, through this dirty, flawed glass crossing the common just below the bandstand. He didn't watch them out of sight in this window, or go to the front windows to get a better angle on them. He guessed they were going over to Laverdier's, and since they had already been there, they would be asking about him. What could the little counter slut tell them? That he had been and gone? Anything else? Only that he had bought 2 pouches of tobacco. Pop smiled. That wasn't likely to hang him. He found a brown bag, went out back, started for the chopping block, considered, then went to the gate in the alleyway instead. Careless once didn't mean a body had to be careless again. After the gate was locked, he took his bag to the chopping block and picked up the pieces of shattered Polaroid camera. He worked as fast as he could, but he took time enough to be thorough. He picked up everything but little shards and splinters that could be seen as no more than anonymous litter. A police lab investigating unit would probably be able to ID some of the stuff left around. Pop had seen TV crime shows when he wasn't watching X-rated movies on the VCR, that was, where those scientific fellows went over the scene of a crime with little brushes and vacuums and even pairs of tweezers, putting things in little plastic bags. But the Castle Rock Sheriff's Department didn't have one of those units, and Pop doubted if Sheriff Pangborn could talk the state police into sending their crime wagon, even if Pangborn himself could be persuaded to make the effort. Not for what was no more than a case of a camera theft, and that was all the Delavans could accuse him of without sounding crazy. Once he had policed the area, he went back inside, unlocked his special drawer, and deposited the brown bag inside. He relocked the drawer and put the keys back in his pocket. That was all right, then. He knew all about search warrants, too. It would be a snowy day in hell before the Delavans could get Pangborn into district court to ask for one of those. Even if he was crazy enough to try, the remains of the goddamn camera would be gone permanently, long before they could turn the trick. To try and dispose of the pieces for good right now would be more dangerous than leaving them in the locked drawer. The Delavans would come back and catch him right in the middle of it. Best to wait, because they would be back. Pop Merrill knew that as well as he knew his own name. Later, perhaps after all this hoorah and foolishment died down, he would be able to go to the boy and say, "Yes, that's right. Everything you think I did, I did. Now why don't we just leave her alone and go back to not knowing each other, all right? We can afford to do that. You might not think so, at least not at first, but we can. Because look, you wanted to bust it up because you thought it was dangerous, and I wanted to sell it because I thought it was valuable. Turned out you was right and I was wrong. That's all the revenge you're ever going to need. If you knew me better, you'd know why. There ain't many men in this town that have ever heard me say such a thing. It sticks in my gut, is what I mean to say. But that don't matter. When I'm wrong, I like to think I'm big enough to own up to it, no matter how bad it hurts. In the end, boy, I did what you meant to do in the first place. We all came out on the same street, is what I mean to say, and I think we ought to let bygones be bygones. I know what you think of me, and I know what I think of you, and neither of us would ever vote for the other one to be Grand Marshal in the annual 4th of July parade. But that's all right. We can live with that, can't we? What I mean to say is just this. We're both glad that goddamn camera is gone. So let's call it quits and walk away." But that was for later, And even then, it was only perhaps. It wouldn't do for right now, that was for sure. They would need time to cool down. Right now, both of them would be raring to tear a chunk out of his ass, like the dog in that picture. Like, well, never mind what they'd be like. The important thing was to be down here, business as usual, and as innocent as a goddamn baby when they got back. Because they would be back. But that was all right. It was all right because...
Because things are under control, Pop whispered. That's what I mean to say.